Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th age. I'm your host, JM, and with me as always are Nick, and Becca, and Mark.
Hey.
Hello.
Howdy. We have a great show for you this week. This week we are interviewing a good friend of the show, Ben Feehan, who has a great idea for a campaign that he and I and some of us have been talking about for a while. So it's kind of a different take on the Dragon Empire and the icons, and so we're just going to jump right into it. Ben, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we normally start off these interviews by trying to fill in the listeners with who you are, kind of what your background is. So how did you get into gaming?
Sort of the most roundabout way possible. I guess 14 years ago, I started with a play-by-post superheroes game that's actually still going. Myself and my good friend, Richard, we started that, or he started that. I joined on shortly after he started that, and that is still going. But that was sort of my gateway drug. I'm not even sure that I necessarily knew it was role-playing at the time. it was just a really fun thing that we were doing. We're all playing superheroes and had character sheets, and it was everything but, you know, at a table with dice.
Now, if I may interrupt you right there, so you and Richard have gone on to write a series of novels.
There are books, yes.
So we will put a link in the show notes to the Grapple Gun universe. Do you want to give just a brief highlight before we head back into your gaming background?
Yeah, no, that's it did. It's gone through six different iterations. We kind of went through six different cities. We've had like 900 characters. It's sort of like the ultimate grand campaign. It's insane. But it did sort of spin out into a series of novels. We ended up basically beginning to start telling the stories of some of these early heroes. And yeah, it's a huge amount of fun. We've had tons of players over the years, but Richard, myself, his wife, are basically the only ones that are still here, which is cool. I mean, if you guys, I'm sure you all know about The Expanse, but that it actually started the same way. It's
right.
role-playing series, role-playing game forum, play-by-post series that the authors were doing together with their wives. So that's a kind of a cool thing.
That's awesome. All right, so you've been playing this game for 14 years. How did you make the transition into tabletop?
Again, it was sort of weird. Just before I got married, sort of my last hurrah of bachelorhood was to like buy all the fourth edition books.
Excellent.
And then realized that I had literally nobody to play with. so I sold them a couple years later in great sadness. But then coming out of that, a couple years after that, I got a chance to actually do some writing for Reroll Productions, which Jam has actually also done some writing for.
Yep.
And be able to do some art direction for them, do some couple adventure paths for them. Yeah, no, it was, and that actually was sort of happening. And just before I really actually got into it again, which again was Richard sort of inviting me to his long running tour campaign, the One Ring campaign. And that really sort of kickstarted sort of the obsession again on a larger scale. So, yeah, now I'm in a bajillion games and enjoying every minute of it.
Are there any specific ones that you're playing right now that you'd like to tell us about?
Well, let's see here. I think I'm in like six different regular games, which is nuts. I mean, Jam runs like six different regular games or more. So, I mean, that's probably not nuts in this group. but everybody I talk to, they're like, whoa, do you have a life? And this is my life. I enjoy this. But I mean, CHF it's all the time. It's, you know, ongoing. It's part of my psyche now. I don't know what I'd do with it if it stopped. So that's the forum. That's the play-by-post game. The tour game, we're 140 sessions in. That's every Monday night, every other Monday night. Had like eight different characters there, 140 sessions. That game is older than some of my kids. I also play in a regular every Tuesday night. I play in his regular his home setting, his setting of Amboria, which is sort of a cross between like War and Peace meets Grimm's Fairy Tales. It's cool.
yeah,
he would have to tell you more about it because it's near and dear to his heart. I'm also in JM's regular Pathfinder game where I play the quarter elf monk Dubrock in Tanar, which it's super fun. And I'm also in another player actually in that game as well. He's also just wanted to try his hand at DMing, so I'm also in his Phandelver 5th edition campaign, having fun with that. I play the gnome rogue inquisitor Joey Sunbeam, who is my at channeling all the noir I've been exposed to for years, but into a small gnome with a hand crossbow. I'm also in JM's semi-regular Jackals campaign.
That's true. We're gonna meet up in October for a big weekend of that.
Yep. So enjoying that, and have been, you know, getting to track that all along the way. So that's been super fun. And then I guess for myself, I was running the rock opera game for quite a while. I ended up having to sort of sideline that because some family stuff, and then needed to end up having all these other games. So I haven't come back to that yet, but that's still waiting in the wings, as well as working on a my wife probably still hates me for this, but doing a DCC game with the kids, which that's excellent. 7, 5, and 4. Poor Erin, she's my oldest. Her first introduction to RPGs in general was we did a DCC funnel, and I sort of broke her poor little soul. It's like this sort of laugh and this like pained expression as her last character dies. Like, you know, maybe we'll find a way to do this funnel without everybody dying. it's just so she doesn't come away with the sense that this is normal. But I mean, not that death shouldn't happen in RPGs, but you know, maybe not like that. Just your entire experience is all four of your beloved characters with names like Beauty and Flower and have died horribly.
I don't know, Ben. For Mark and me, that was our experience. well, that's another one dead.
Yeah, it wasn't even a funnel. It was just, oh, okay, I guess I'll roll up another character.
Yeah. But I do love the funnel, though, and I am planning on it's going to be a post-apocalyptic game set using the America Survival Guide and the MCC, the Mutant Call Classics. We're going to do it with something a little less lethal so that their characters disappear or are recaptured by the Ant-Man as opposed to dying whenever they get knocked out. So hopefully that'll keep it a little less scarring.
That's good for him. Yeah. So you mentioned that you've played a lot of games and you've run some games. Which do you prefer, DMing or playing?
You know, that's a good question. For me, DMing is like highly aspirational. Like it combines so many disciplines and so many good things that I should know how to do that it ends up being a little daunting. So, but it's something I need to do and I like to do. You know, storytelling is something I love, but it's also something I know I need to get better at. So it's always a little daunting to look at GMing and go, you know, to jump right into it. I always feel like I'm doing less than I could, which I think has a lot to do with the fact that my two GMs that I play with are mostly JM with his, what? I mean, how many years have you been running?
And more than I'd like to.
54.
That's yeah, exactly. It's been forever.
Wow. How old do you guys think I am? probably close to, I think, 28 years.
Yeah. See that. So my two GMs are JM and then Richard, who's his entire thing is this grand campaign, which the other day it was like, I described it as he doesn't work in broad strokes. He's like a Mobius painting where there's a million details that make up the entire whole. I have some very bright lights I stand among. And so GMing for me is, like I said, very aspirational. So it's something I do enjoy doing, and I end up being far more improvisational than I want to be when I'm doing it. Playing is something that I also really enjoy. I really enjoy seeing the GM enjoy it when I am able to embrace his world and able to contribute to it. And I guess when I'm able to really grok it, I guess, that's something I really enjoy. And I've had a lot of fun also sort of playing with just concepts. Character concepts is always something I've enjoyed. And I mean, like I said, on the Play by Post game, we've had like 900 characters over the course of the game, which is nuts, but that's just being able to try out new ideas is something I've always enjoyed. So long-term, I really do love a long form game, but playing in multiple games is, you know, I get to try a lot of different story ideas and a lot of different concepts and characters, and that's fun for me.
You had mentioned that one of the games that you had run was this idea of a rock opera, and that's kind of one of the things we wanted to talk about in this episode. So could you kind of unpack a little bit, what is this Gygaxian rock opera?
Yeah, for sure. Well, basically, back when I was first getting into role-playing, right after sort of I started playing with Richard and his regular One Ring game, anytime you spend any time on the internet with gaming circles, tabletop gaming circles, you hear these people pitching this idea of like, what if you played an entire party where they're all bards and you're a rock band and you're on tour, but you're completely broke and you have to do, you know, do dungeons to make ends meet between gigs. And everybody would always talk about it, and they would get, you know, passed around a million times. You'd see the same meme with someone, you know, someone's Tumblr post reposted, you know, seven times in the course of a month, where someone was pitching this idea. And I was like, okay, so that sounds like fun. Let's do it. So the idea effectively is, as opposed to you all meet in a tavern, or, you know, you all wake up in the same prison cell, or someone recruits you. The idea is that the real reason for being together as characters is you are in a rock band together, which doesn't mean you don't meet in a tavern, and it doesn't mean you don't necessarily aren't recruited. And it's a Gygaxian rock opera because it's set in a traditionally Gygaxian world. Classic fantasy tropes, of at least tabletop fantasy tropes, elves, dwarves, gnomes, and so on. I'm a huge fan of Terry Pratchett. That's one thing that Pratchett did there so well, was basically take something that's normal, like modern technology or something, and put it into Ankh-Morpork and then sort of twist it so that it's a fantasy element, or it's a technology that's run by magic, and then just sort of watch what happens. The Gygaxian rock opera was sort of a chance to do something very similar. And I've run two different campaigns over it now, and ran into a couple of things. You know, first of all, being played straight, it's kind of clunky. The idea of ever doing an all bard group, it sort of burns on impact on account of everybody being bards. I have found the idea is solid. It's something that you can, it gives you, as far as a campaign goes, you've got stakes, you've got a goal, you've got something that all the characters have a part to play. You know, nobody's getting sidelined because, you know, we're not doing magic now and I'm the barbarian, or we're doing magic now and I'm the barbarian, so I just have to sit here silently, or, you know, talk about my various debaucheries while everyone else is doing the important stuff.
All right, so I know you and I have discussed this possibly ad nauseum with Richard. How do you define Gygaxian? Because you put it in, right, the Gropa, right?
True, yeah.
So you kind of touched on it, kind of standard fantasy tropes, but is there something that really makes...
I think it's classic D&D with all the sort of expectation of the pantheons, of the magic, of the sort of weird delineations of monsters, of the, you know, there's divine magic and there's nature magic and then there's arcane magic and all these sort of weird little quirky bits that have sort of just sort of worked their way into the expectations in your average D&D 13th age Pathfinder type game. I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel or anything like that with adding new races or anything like that. Just sort of your classic D&D game, except now rock and roll. That only goes so far because... As one thing I sort of realized as I was getting into this and I was doing a lot of research into like the history of rock and roll, is tied deeply to technology and the distribution. And so eras and genres and everything are springing out of, you know, what's going on in the political atmosphere, but also who's actually listening and how you're getting the music to those listeners. So had to find ways to make that work. And those core conceits and concepts work within sort of a universe where technology hasn't obviously reached the point where we're using wireless transmission for to beam music into our homes. The Gygaxian fantasy being everything that's been left to us by the last 50 plus years of Wizards of the Coast and their kin and I guess progeny, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
Do you think there are any key themes in your rock opera game that you follow?
I mean, for starters, every single time I've run this, there's been key themes that have been key to me that I think the players more or less ignore, which has been probably about perfect.
That sounds about right.
Like, I mean, for example, balancing art versus avarice, right? Are you selling out? Are you the guy who believes that art should only ever be experienced and so smashes his guitar on the stage? You know, are you the Who? Or are you...
Don't you talk bad about the Who.
I don't think he was.
Oh, okay.
You know, I love the Who. I love me some classic rock. I don't think I could do this without loving the classics. Are you the Justin Bieber of the world who creates endlessly as long as someone is paying you to do it? But in my experience, you know, when the players actually get into it, the classic murder hobo fits really well because you end up half the group is like, I'm an artist. I love rock and roll. I am going to put on a show. The other half are like, when are we getting paid? And why are we doing this again? Which is perfect, because that's one of the other themes you always have, is there is always an internal tension, which, you know, the history of rock and roll as we know it is just sort of shredded by band breakups and by internal rivalries and by rivals between people who could have been, should have been friends, and, you know, who didn't end up making the, you know, great music because, well, they just frankly couldn't get along, or their pride didn't let them. But I think the other thing that a theme that comes up a lot is that band members are not all bards. one of my favorite examples is, you know, look at like the band Queen. All right. So you have Freddie Mercury, who is just this, he's the bard. he's this over the top character. Mm-hmm. With, you know, his own secrets and comes with this amazing backstory. And then you have Brian Mays, who's an astrophysicist.
Yep.
And, you know, he's literally the wizard. And so, you know, the people are suggesting, you know, do an all bard group. I'm like, you know what? That's not how it works. You look at almost any band, and one of those person was like, you know, a former lion tamer or some other weird nonsense before they end up being in a band. And so it's to me, that's one of the best things, is just sort of to see in the rock opera games that I've run, sort of the weird characters that people come up with that now, you know, they're here and they're part of a rock band, and that's the assumption. Everybody's fine with it.
Well, the stories I've heard, Roger Daltrey was the fighter, because if you didn't show up, he made sure that you understood that the Who was disappointed with you and woke you up with his fists.
Which, you know, we've had characters like that in the couple of games that I've run. A couple of games that I've run, it's been people's first RPG experience, which has been interesting and been fun, because I think it gave them sort of an entry point in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise. One group I had, it was all gals there in their either early 20s or late teens, and they were all pretty unsure about the whole idea of fantasy, of playing tabletop RPGs in general, but then fantasy tabletop RPGs. They had like zero entry point besides like Lord of the Rings, and we weren't doing Lord of the Rings, so, you know, where do we go from here? But putting in the context of, oh, you're these characters, you're in a band, you're trying to get on a label, and then you're going to go on tour, and everything else that happens is sort of ancillary and supporting that, was something that was really easy for them to get into, and something that they could really connect with, like, oh, yeah, okay, you know, we have to perform now, we have to do these things, to the point where, you know, people are spending spells on stage to try to make this, you know, to kick the performance up a notch. You know, fairy fire does wonders for your, you know, pyrotechnics on stage.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, you can do cool things with magic. The other thing that comes up a lot is the personal cost of art, which sounds funny, but also if you look at it again historically, half the reason artists are party animals, and this is something that don't think it's communicated very often, like just at face value, is because performing and the tour schedule and everything they're asking these people to do is insane. Like, the level of energy they're asking you to put out on stage just to be a rock artist is nuts. Why? I mean, of course these people are blowing off mass amounts of steam and doing tons of cocaine. Being able to sort of lean into that with the characters, well, that's what they end up doing. They end up discovering that, you know, they are burned out, or their characters, you know, can't keep doing this, but yet they still are asked to. That's another big theme, that, you know, the cost, the personal cost of doing this, and what are you going to do to handle this? Which, in a lot of ways, just the resource economy. I originally ran this in fifth edition. At its core, that's about a resource economy. And so being able to really sort of sink your teeth into that and use that as a way to sort of drive this idea home was really fun. The other theme, and this is probably my favorite theme for the rock opera concept in general, is that music is magic. That's not just true in fantasy. I mean, if you think about it for any length of time, what is magic? If you're thinking at it like looking at it from the perspective of, say, like a wizard who is studying this thing, the idea being that magic is this application of reason to the supernatural in such a way that to create a measurable effect, right? So think about that for, you know, for 30 seconds, and you've got music. You have math combined with art and skill and, you know, a very technical skill that creates something beautiful, that creates this art that has a huge impact. And most of the impact is emotional and is, you know, affects people in non-measurable, but also deeply measurable ways, but also very impactful ways. So, I mean, in many senses, in the real world, music is magic. But in a fantasy setting, in like the Gygaxian rock opera, you have a way to actually sort of lean into that and say, okay, this is having a measurable effect. There's a reason why rock and roll is taking root, is because, you know, this magic has a way of getting inside of people. Because we're talking about things like technology and the distribution of this music and how it, you know, gets out there, which I think this is another issue that you run into with people who've tried this game before, is they sort of ignore the fact that some core concepts. They basically treat it like your rock band is just a traveling bardic group that just plays intense percussion music. It's not, you could have the same game without these people being in a band, which is not really what I'm looking for in the rock opera.
Mm-hmm. You want that as more core.
It's who you are. Yeah. It's who you are as characters. And part of that is that what you're doing actually has to have an effect on the world. So what's important to you, you're trying to make that important to the world as well. That's the whole part of the point of being a rocker, being a musician, is that you're trying to share this. So in my rock opera game, music being magic, you end up drawing a lot of attention. You end up waking things up that have been asleep for a long time, because this music, this magic you're creating, is having an effect on the world around you. One thing that I sort of lean into is the idea that music is this thing that for millennia was something you really only experienced in person, right? Something that you had to actually go somewhere with and participate with to really experience it. But now, where we live nowadays, it's something that you can do, you run into everywhere, because you can pipe it into your ears from anywhere.
Right.
And so looking at, okay, if music is magic, what does that look like? What does that mean? And so music almost becomes a sort of time loop in the setting where your album, which in this case is actually a book, a magical book that has these songs inside of it, becomes almost a sort of like a self-contained time loop where this music is reproducible.
We're crystallizing these moments that used to be very ephemeral.
Exactly. Like you could do the same thing with photography or whatnot. It's the same concept, is that if this is actually magic, in some senses you are binding something. And in my Gygaxian rock opera game, the idea was that the more you did this, the more you had a buildup of magic in one place, and that attracted some attention. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, that lets you get super metal with it, if you like. We had, in both games, there is this mysterious comet that is hurtling through the sky, and nobody knows exactly what it is. Except eventually the players find out that it's the severed skull of a ancient death god who coming back for all this built up magic in one place in an attempt to return to his original form. So in some senses, the players are contributing to an apocalypse. In my original campaign, they didn't really pick up on the clues, which I don't, sometimes GM secret, I don't know if that's my fault or not.
No, players are horrible.
No, not at all.
like I don't know if that was my fault. Like, should I have made this more explicit?
You could write it on a note and give it to them and they would still miss it.
Every time they played this music, this ancient book of necromancy they found would vibrate and begin to watch them. It was sort of like the book from Ash versus the Living Dead, where it, you know, turns and looks at them whenever they're playing, practicing. And they were just like, oh, that thing's creepy. And, you know, put it under a pile of blankets. Eventually, on their first stop on the tour, they ended up playing. They were doing fantastic. They were killing it. The crowd was loving it. And they ended up summoning the black dragon of the apocalypse, who opened a portal to the world of the dead and, you know, basically had the zombie apocalypse. They all died, and yeah, the gods basically pulled them aside, and they had to convince a council of gods not to just delete the whole universe that they came from. But thankfully, they had a guardian angel who they didn't know was a guardian angel until he died. He was one of their groupies. and he was able to help assist them in Yeah, he died saving them from a mummy, which they also summoned unintentionally. See, I left them all these clues, guys.
You did. It's not your fault, Ben. Yeah,
you had it correct at the beginning when you called them murder hobos, because that's all players are.
So
says one of the players in my game.
That's right. You drop hints. We don't care. Where's the loot?
They still died, but they got sent back to do a sort of Mad Max rock opera in a world full of zombies. It was great. They immediately ran into a group of gnomes, Starflower and the Alchemist cover band. Since they were dead, it was a tribute band. It was nice.
So with all this, how do you think this would be a good fit in 13th Age?
Well, there's a few different ways. First of all, 13th Age is at its core an homage to Gygaxian fantasy in a lot of different ways. But also there is a ton of room for with the icons to use them as key players, turning your world into something that works with the rise of rock and the rock band. Because again, if you simply plug a rock band into a fantasy world and expect it to hit go, it works, but it doesn't feel quite right. But if you're able to do something like, for example, turning one of your icons into labels, for example, and you are immediately beholden to your icons because they're your label, and then you might obviously be at odds with another icon who is a rival label, or you can also turn them into like genre luminaries, because again, throughout the history of rock, you have various figures who sort of defined the entire genre. You know, people like, you know, Bob Dylan and the whole New York folk scene. And, you know, the way that basically he sort of defined an entire generation of artists, you can have a character who was an icon who was effectively this sort of genre luminary, complete with all their flaws and idiosyncrasies, but yet you are beholden to them, or you could also have your career ruined because this person thinks you're trash. You know, you're not an artist, thinks you're a sellout, for example. You also have cultural forces For example, you might have the church who might think that rock is the work of the diabolist. You might also be able to spin something similar with something like technology. I really liked the last episode where you guys were talking about Tanar and your icons in Tanar, and how a lot of them weren't necessarily individuals. Some of them were cults who were after specific things. For example, like the cult of the firstborn. That was a really cool idea. And something very similar with technology. As a rise of technology. For example, in my original game, one of the gods was the cricket, as sort of a shout out to Buddy Holly, because he was one of the first people to really do kind of a modern cut together of the way music is created now in studio, in the sense that you do hundreds of takes, you fit together the best parts, and it becomes this really polished, really clean, really high-end product that, you know, you can't necessarily reproduce every time on stage, but what people are getting, you know, on their Victrola is very high quality. You know, he spawned the Beatles. They're called the Beatles because it was a homage to the crickets. You could easily do something like that where you either create someone like that, a luminary, or something that he's left behind, a sort of legacy or technology. Perhaps you have a system where you're using ley lines now as a way of wireless transmission. And that could be, there could be people who control that, just like there were people who controlled the radio stations and what was actually played. So there's a huge amount of room for especially the icons to sort of use it as a way to shape your universe and make it compatible and functional within a rock opera.
Well, and from what you were saying, like just like kind of back at the beginning where... Uh-huh. If it's all bards, it sort of falls flat.
Yes.
But if you've got the group and then you've got the icons that are tied into the world, then why each person is sort of working towards this end, that's just another way that 13th Age gives you some more narrative, like a narrative feedback loop. Well, yes. You know, I have this positive relationship with the cricket, therefore I'm going to be doing this. I have a negative relationship with the Archmage because, man, that dude controls, you know, the ley line network and he's keeping the man down. And that...
Screw that guy.
The Archmage always ends up kind of as a... I mean, he's written as a positive icon, but in basically all of my games, he's the man.
I picture the Crusaders being totally heavy metal.
And I should also mention that there's a lot of room, just because I mean, if anybody has ever studied like the history of like Elvis, there's so much connection to organized crime going on with some of these groups, with some of these bands and some of these performers, that you could very easily pull something like that in as well as an icon and as sort of a pressure point for the entire campaign.
So Ben, one of the questions that has been kind of rattling around my mind the entire time you've been talking about this, because you're describing that these performances are, and this rock group is the core of the whole story. It's not just a sideline. This is the focal point of it all.
Right.
None of the games that I'm aware of, and I know 13th Age itself doesn't have any mechanics specifically for something like that. So have you come up with any new mechanics for that, or how have you handled that?
Yeah, that is something that actually I had to, we right away looked at and we're like, okay, we need to do something, especially performance mechanic, because there are performance mechanics. If you go back all the way back to AD&D, there is literally algebra. There's an actual equation which you can do that will tell you, okay, here is the type of audience you have, and that gives you a specific number. Here is the number of that audience, that gives you a specific number. You multiply that times the type of genres they're into, and that gives you another multiplier, and then finally you get the difficulty of that check if you're going to do performance check.
I just want to say that was amazing. Like,
yeah, it's too much math.
That's
for me.
Amazing.
I need to dig out the Dragon Magazine issue where that's in. It's maybe we can link to it in the show notes or something. But they totally break it down. You know, if you're playing it for halflings, if you're playing for elves, if you're playing for dwarves, if you're playing for humans, and are they wealthy humans? Are they poor humans? You know, and then what that's going to require. And I took one look at that and meant, okay, I'm not doing that.
Right.
It's like, I'm already doing a huge amount of work here, having to do this kind of math every single time. I'm not averse to it. I know some GMs would probably dig that, but that wasn't for me.
We're trying to do it on the fly.
Exactly. So their performance mechanic, I've tried a few different things. One thing that worked really well was sort of assigning a value to each of the different songs. Both the games that I had, players sort of made out their own, and they made up their own songs. Here's the songs we're playing, but each of the songs fit a certain type of song. Is this a heartbreaker? Is this an anthem? And each of those songs were tied to a certain attribute. They rolled a check versus that specific attribute, whatever they were going for. And that worked. It did make the performance a little longer, a little more tedious, but I ended up sort of going with a modified version of that where basically assign each person to do a role for the song. So, okay, this is your chance to shine. You know, you make the role for this. And it was fun because the players got to pick, okay, who's doing this song. The players also got to pick, you know, what's their actual set list was going to be kind of based on their strengths as a team. You know, I gave them performance bonus if they actually took some time to practice.
Bands don't do that.
Right. I mean, we can all be the Sex Pistols and just make it happen. and there were a few times they did. There were a few times they got a disadvantage for being just completely hammered from the night before. We had this one character. He's our lead guitar, and he's Azimar. And so he's the pretty boy, right? We were doing this battle of the bands, and he rolls this natural 20, and it was just this beautiful moment of like, you know, he's going into full angel mode. There's like glowing, and the wings are, you know, spreading out behind him, and you know, his shirt is suddenly, you know, popped open, and it was amazing. You know, and there's the people are fainting in the audience. It was, but that's the sort of thing doing a little more personalized, you know, is this your moment sort of thing lets you do. But again, it really depends on the GM. That could be a little too complicated for some people. They might want to do it something faster. They might want to say, okay, we're a band. This is our big moment. This is our thing. But also I don't want to spend the entire session, you know, role-playing just basically a bunch of roles to see how this went. When I was talking about it with GM, he was like, you should treat it like an encounter. It should be, you know, the performance should have hit points, and your characters should have, you know, their roles should effectively be attacks. So depending on how well they're performing, it will, you know, sort of work down the performance, the hit points on the performance until you have whether a successful or a failed performance. And I was like, dude, I've been running this for 4 years. How did I not think of that? It was brilliant. So if I were to run it again, I would probably do some combination of exactly what he's talking about and the set list, Just because the set list was just super fun for the characters and for the people to pull together.
Well, it's almost like a montage.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I like that a lot.
The other thing, and this is something that I think was really important and that I realized just sort of even listening to the history of rock and roll, is that your players don't have to all be bards, but they do need to have a specific role in the band. And again, this is something that players really dig. But that also comes with, that role in the band comes with certain abilities, I guess. So I basically broke it down into the five classic five-man band. You know, you find in basically all pop culture in some place if you got a group. And it fit really well. So you have the front man, right? He's the leader. There's always, every group, there's somebody who ends up more or less being the guy who talks. That's your front man. And in all the games I played, that guy was the bard. Then you have your lead guitar, who's the lieutenant. He's the guy who backs you up. He's usually a heartthrob, but he never really steals the limelight from your front man. You of course have to have your bass, who's your heavy, but usually he's the barbarian. In all my games, my wife has actually played the heavy, on the bass, and she's a Goliath fighter with this torrid and horrifying PTSD backstory that I gave her just because. So you also have three other characters. You gotta have the drummer, who's the maniac. And, you know, if you want to kill him every session, you can, a la Spinal Tap. You also have the heart, which is the roadie. You know, this guy that is always there and always sort of reminds you what you're actually doing this for. And then you have the brains. You have the keyboardist. Again, if you've ever seen any ensemble show, you always have some version of these characters there. Mm-hmm. So it was really fun to sort of trying to develop some small mechanics that sort of reflect these roles. The last one is one that I sort of ended up having to add after I sat there and looked at this long enough. Every successful band has a tour manager. Mm-hmm. And that tour manager is usually as much of a character as any of the people on stage. He's either this total jerk who's paying no attention and just taking all the money, which is equally fun to play. Or he can be this hard case who is keeping everybody in line. He's the band dad. Or mom. In our current campaign, my buddy Richard is playing Michael Beholder, who's a beholder tour manager. He's the most conniving, awful person, but he also makes sure that they do well every time, usually by like seriously hamstringing any rival bands or buying off anybody who needs bought off. It's fantastic. But mechanically speaking, we went through and essentially assigned certain special abilities to each of these specific roles. So, for example, the frontman, the leader, he can do an ability called From the Top, where basically he can ask to reroll the initiative and basically reset everything. Because he's the frontman. He's like, okay, stop everything. We've got, you know, From the Top. or then you have like your bass, where he does the bass solo. He gets to make an extra attack. Like once per encounter, he gets his extra attack because he's doing his bass solo. Of course, you have your drummer, which in this case, I basically was doing, he gets us, you know, like a plus one for every time he hits in a row, because he's got to keep that rhythm and he's keeping it all together until he misses.
So would you see those more as maybe feats that the group could take, or overlays that you would just toss out and say, hey, we're doing this, so here's an overlay?
Right. I think that'd probably be ideal, especially for something like 13th Age. Probably feats is probably the ideal place for it.
Well, cool. Well, do you guys have any more questions for Ben about this? Because I don't know about you, but this was just, I've been looking forward to doing this and having Ben on the show, because I find the Gropera just...
which for anybody who's wondering where that horrible name came from, that's the Gygaxian rock opera, but
GR opera. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But turn into the worst possible version.
It is a pretty terrible version, but what can you do?
So when your characters were making those various music sets or the song sets for the performances, were they actually writing out lyrics for the songs, or just coming up with titles? Or
they were mostly coming up with titles. And they, in most cases, they were simply saying, okay, I want to write a heartbreaker. What have we got for my backstory? What have we run into? but yeah, they were basically just making up names. Which was fun too, because it's just sort of stare into space for a minute and then, you know, come up with something that they pull off the wall, which, you know, like they saw the inspiring text on a poster on the wall and then turned that into a song, which weirdly felt pretty much like how a lot of songs are written at some point. Like, you just pull that out of thin air, the words fit together, it works. I mean, that seems like how half the Led Zeppelin songs are written. Oh.
Well, just recently saw an interview with Chris Martin of Coldplay. They were asking him where he came up with Yellow. He's like, I just wanted to write a song that would make my mates laugh. And they're like, but no, there's all this stuff in there. He's like, no, no, stars aren't yellow. Stars are white, unless it's on like a card. I just thought it was funny to sing to them, and they all thought it was funny, and so we wrote the song.
Exactly.
Ben, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're great, Ben.
Yeah.
I totally see the Orcs as punk rock band.
Yeah, the Orc Lords.
Shoving each other, you know, the mosh pit comes from them, yes. You know.
Yeah. I had one player who was a half orc, and he worshipped the god Mosh. Yes, one of that involved, there's a lot of, yes, there's a pit, there's dancing, there's a lot of shoving.
If stabbing.
If noses get broken, yes, then all the better.
We'll link to your stuff you did for Jade Punk, and we'll link to Shadowcraft and the GGU.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. And Ben, thanks for coming on and talking with us about your sort of very interesting take on 13th Age and the rock opera. Like, again, you and I have talked about this for a while, so.
Yeah. It's been cooking up there for years, so it's fun to talk about it.
Cool. And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a patron at patreon.com/iconicpodcast. Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, you can contact us at iconicpodcast@gmail.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And be sure to check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.